Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and today I couldn't ask for better company to be holed up in a cosy studio with. My first guest took the music scene by storm over 25 years ago, though he doesn't like to be reminded of that, when his band Suede became the face of Britpop. Singer, songwriter, author Brett Anderson, welcome to Book Off.
Thank you, Joe. Lovely to be here.
And lovely to have you.
Thank you so much.
Joining him on our lovely sofa seat, the official poet of the 2012 Olympics, a BAFTA-nominated writer with an MBE and is now Chancellor of the University of Manchester. Just a few strings to your bow, Lem Sisse, welcome.
Thank you very much for displaying those strings, harp-like.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Very prestigious. You know, I just got the face of Britpop. You know, I didn't.
No.
You know, that's, you know.
That's the way to do it.
Not the official Brett poet of the Olympic Games, God.
Brett has got a name of a writer. You know? Yes. Brett is just—he was made to be a writer. So I'm on your side.
We're swap size.
Yeah. And what's lovely is already you have each other's books in front of you, so you've already swapped these two brilliant memoirs, which we're going to talk about. And for those who are new to the Book Off podcast, let me explain that a little later on, both my guests will be pitching a book to us that they love and think that we should all read. They're going to get 3 minutes on the clock if they choose to use it, and after each pitch, I'll decide which book to take home. So we'll find out what those are a little later on. First, though, I do want to talk about these two books, because you've both recently published memoirs, and they're both absolutely fantastic, very different. I ate them up. Brett, the last time I saw you was at an event in Bath, I believe, and this was for your first memoir, Cold Black Morning. And here we are talking about Afternoons with the Blinds Drawn, which was a book that you didn't think you'd write.
No, the first chapter of this is actually called The Book I Said I Wouldn't Write, in a slightly wry way. I suppose it's, you know, the whole point of the first memoir was that it didn't delve into kind of the rock clichés. It stopped very consciously at the point where most rock biographies start. It stopped where the band got signed, and I thought that was a very kind of like a sort of symbolic moment. And I suppose people say, well, why have you written the second one? And I thought, well, two reasons. Firstly, I really enjoyed the process of writing with Cold Black Mornings. I kind of enjoyed it much more than I thought I would. And secondly, I thought what I could do with the second book, whereas the first one is more of a kind of like Bildungsroman, kind of, you know, the artist as a young man kind of backstory, the prehistory. What I wanted to do with this one is look at my experiences as a singer, songwriter, sort of person that got sort of like dragged through the machinery of stardom and fame, and look at what that did to me as a person, sort of psychologically. And I thought that was an interesting standpoint, because I'm sure someone can correct me, but I'm not really aware of other books that have done that. It seems to me that either you have the kind of like the cultural commentator's point of view of someone else looking at what happened to them, you know, the story of Judy Garland, what happened to why she became like she did, her childhood, blah, 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 blah. Or you get the first person autobiography, which tends to be in rock autobiographies, tends to be a story of success and collapse and drugs and excess and all of these things. But they tend not to go much deeper than that. It tends to be a series of things that happen to the subject. Mm. And what I wanted to look at was why these things had happened to me and what it was, kind of like analyse the machinery around me that had caused these things. And I thought that was an interesting standpoint.
It really is. It's such a different approach to it. And like you say, Brett, the autobiographies that I've read of those classic sort of rock star things are like, we were out in the gutter, then we did this, and then we just took all these drugs, and it was, you know, and it's like, great, okay, because you get the sort of showbiz rock and roll tips, but this is just so much, it's just so interesting to look at it from this side that you've done. And I want to talk more about certainly the press and that, what that sort of had on you in just a moment. Lem, if I can come to you though, because you've also published your memoir, your first memoir, and it's received a lot of attention already. And I was saying to Brett earlier, I think this must have been quite a hard book for you to have written, to have delved back, to have put on the page, would you say?
Hard to live. I mean, nothing will get close to actually the life of that first 18 years.
Yeah.
So relatively easy to write. Previous to the publication, I'd used the files to take the government to court. So I'd had 3.5 years to acclimatise myself to the fact that every 2 months a stranger was writing a report about my progress in my life that would have a fundamental effect on me and my life. So, no, I was ready to write this. Now, by the time this was, I was ready to write this, very ready. I'm match ready at the moment regarding the story. It's a live story, man. So I don't think it would be fair to put out a book of this emotional impact without being somewhat emotionally ready to do it.
It's called My Name Is Why, and obviously there's many issues that you tackle in this book, and from what you're saying there, it's time now to be talking about them.
WikiLeaks, you know, even the way Brett's book is going into the machinery of the business, you know, this is the machinery of the business of childcare that stole a child, changed his name, denied him of his family, and then left him in the wilderness. But it is looking at the machinery, the actual, you know, it would be interesting in Brett's book, actually, come to think of it, to see some of the contractual kind of doublespeak that happens that puts you in a position where you find yourself at times without advice. Mm. You know, this book of mine shows the actual reports from the social services, which somehow made me invisible. I mean, how can that happen, that you can have a report written every 3 months?
I thought a really very moving little detail that you mentioned is how no one was allowed to take photographs.
Yep.
And that made you invisible. And so, in a sense, your childhood and your past was kind of taken away from you. Because there was no records of it. And that really moved me. I thought that was just so incredibly sad, you know, the way that most people kind of like, you flick through family albums and you're reminded of these times, and you didn't have that, and that was so moving to me. And it's a beautiful little detail and so powerful. And I think on a wider sense, you know, in a wider sense, you writing a book like this, it's having a very, very personal element, which of course it does, because it's about your upbringing, it's so important, because sometimes subjects like children in care, it can come across as dry if it's from an official report or something like that. But the fact that it's got a personal element, it's so much more powerful, and so much more moving than a dry sort of intellectual investigation.
Yes, and a lobbying book, you know, book that would say this issue needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
It's not doing that. It's looking at the specific story of a boy in relation to the files. Yeah, thanks, Brett.
It's so important. I think in a way that's, you know, and an even wider point that, you know, that's the power of art.
Mm.
You know, to take the general and to personalise it. You know, it's that whole thing of, like, you know, you can read a thousand stories about the atrocities in Syria, for example, and you see a photograph of a boy in debris or something, and suddenly it moves you much more, and a powerful memoir like yours can be so much more important than a thousand kind of official reports on these matters, I think.
Thanks, you Brett. That's it.
Yes.
Because you, Lem, you were 17 when you realised that your name wasn't Norman.
Yeah. Thank God for that. Yeah. Actually, I'm not saying anything against the name Norman, actually. It means man of the north. I found out only a couple of years ago, which is actually, you know, sort of has its poignance with my work. But I found out that my name was Lem Cisse when I was 17 and a half because I had to be given my birth certificate.
Yeah, that must have been such a strange kind of thing when it came to your own identity, because to know yourself as in one name and then suddenly to uncover that you had another name. Did you have sort of issues about were? And
at 17 and a half, I realised that I'd been scammed, you know, somehow, that I was about to leave the childcare system. When they said to me, we have to give you your birth certificate, so we have to tell you your name, that's basically what this was. It wasn't a personal sort of helping of me, I don't think. Well, no, maybe it was, but to a degree. When I saw that my name on my birth certificate was Lem Cisse, I then knew that I'd been cheated.
Yes.
So I was then, you know, I then was like, okay, how did this happen? And the more I investigated how that happened, the more I got to, oh, you stole me from my mother and you imprisoned me as a child. And this is proof that something's wrong right at the beginning of my life. So I then had to, you know, embark on the journey of finding out what happened, and that took till 2015.
Does it feel like a different, like those 17 years was a different person in some ways?
No. I feel like I am the guy. You know, the beauty of seeing these files is that I know that I was the kid that became the man.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any proof of that before. Like not having photographs, I didn't have a person to say, oh, you were the funny kid, or you were the depressing kid, or you were the thoughtful kid, or you were any. I had no relativity. So the idea of not having a photograph is symbolic of so much more. Mm. And I can look in these files and see, oh, no, I was always a sparky kid. I was a sparky kid when I was a kid. It's there. It's written. It's proof.
Yeah,
that's what your family does. It says to you, you know, you were this, you were that, and then you can argue with that.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Photos are, you know, they're part of your story, aren't they? They're part of your story as a person. They're part of your very much your identity. And we all need to tell ourselves stories about who we are, don't we?
Yes, even if somehow. It's not true, it doesn't matter whether what I thought.
They're never true.
In many ways, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
A story is a story. That, you know, we're all kind of constructing our own personas
unconsciously,
kind of slowly building a little nest out of these little feathers of bits of reality. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And making this sort of like slightly brittle kind of like edifice, you know, and that's our persona, you know, this kind of like weird little nest we make kind of thing.
That's
you know,
that's so true. This is, and yours as well. Both of our books are somehow, you know, those nests, we are nest. That's such a powerful metaphor.
I'm fascinated with the concept of persona and identity. It's something that really fascinates me. Having been through, you know, with the kind of quote unquote the sort of fame machine sort of thing, and how it distorts who you are, and that difference between you who you believe you are and who other people believe you to be, and that huge chasm between those two things. And at points in my career, looking back, the chasm has been huge, and at points it's been closer together. And that's a really interesting dynamic. How that changes.
It's just funny that is precisely my book as well, from a very different perspective, but actually very similarly, you know, the idea of be who you are and who you're told
absolutely,
you are.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the power of people telling you who you are, how that can affect you,
yes,
but or how you can defend yourself against that,
yeah,
or how the two can come together. It's like precisely what you said.
Yeah.
In the fame machine, which can distort.
Yeah.
But then we can distort. I can distort my idea of myself
as well.
You know,
because we're all telling ourselves stories about ourselves, aren't we? We're kind of editing these things. You know, we're sort of like choosing the stories to tell about ourselves because we've got a story about who we kind of want to be, who we want, what the us that we want to present to the world. And it's really interesting, the concept of storytelling, because it's not just personal. It's kind of like, you know, you get it in sort of like the story of a nation, for example, you know, the kind of like the story that Great Britain decides to tell the world of who it is kind of thing. And that's constantly being revised and, you know, and we're finding it at the moment with the whole Brexit debate, aren't we? You know, the kind of what story are we trying to tell the world about who we are, and the difference between the two stories that the Leavers and the Remainers want to tell about themselves. Yeah. You know, it's a fascinating thing. So that, you know, we're all this constant thing about we're telling stories, you know, and
they're
brings,
believable. We believe them in our deepest,
of course, and they're both truth and fiction at the same time. You know, they're not. It's not kind of lies. They're part truth and part fiction. Right. You know, it's a fascinating idea, I think. You know,
talking of photographs and how Lemmy's saying, you know, there are none of your childhood and growing up. And Brett, one thing that struck me from reading your memoir is, you know, just how much you were in front of a lens in those early years of Suede and beyond.
Ironically, I haven't printed any photographs in the book.
No, you didn't need to, though, because the way you talk about that garnered press attention, and, you know, how from interviews with the Melody Maker, and then you're on 19 covers before the first album's even come out. Yeah. So what effect did that complete opposite have on you? I know we're not talking about your childhood and such, but, you know, just being plastered everywhere.
Still my kind of, you know, still my formative years. I mean, even though I wasn't technically a child, this was happening in my sort of mid-20s when you know, there's kind of scientific evidence to suggest that our brains aren't fully developed until we kind of like get into our late 20s. So you're still kind of, I'm still developing as a person. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I ask the question in the book, you know, what kind of person would I have been if this thing hadn't happened to me? That fascinates me. That kind of, that sliding doors idea about, you know, if I'd have led a different life, what kind of a person, and you can never know, you know, but it does fascinate me. You know, constantly being scrutinised like that. And I think it kind of like, it makes you, I think I'm only beginning in the last few years, possibly in the last 10 years, to sort of deconstruct myself and deconstruct my persona and to kind of like find out who I am to a certain extent. I think having children really, really affected me there, because I think, you know, as soon as I had a child, I suddenly wasn't the most important person in the world. this little screaming kind of like blob of flesh was the most important person in the world. this milky, burpy little sick machine was more important than me. And so that was really interesting. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, what kind of effect do these things have on you? I suppose that, you know, they make you self-conscious, they make you vain, they make you brittle, they make you arrogant, all of these things, you know. And it's only looking back on these things that you realise what a kind of like, you're amazed that anyone really survives any of these things. And I think there's lots of casualties. The fame machine, for want of a better kind of term, it's amoral. It doesn't have an opinion about anything. It's just it's like a tool. It's like a machine. Mm. It doesn't have a moral standpoint. It kind of magnifies things. It extremifies things. It acts as a sort of like a catalyst that speeds things up. It magnifies the extremities of one's personality.
And thinking about, we have to realize that back then, in the sort of early to mid 90s, the press and specifically the music press was huge. It was a swell of,
absolutely, yeah, yeah,
you know, it's how people learn about these
things. It was kind of like central to the kind of like the media of the time. And this is another interesting point that I touch on, wondering about anyone that reads my book that wasn't aware of how the media used to work in the 90s and the years before the internet would be aware of how important things like the NME were. And nowadays, they're, you know, they still exist in some form, but their relevance is definitely marginal now compared to, you know, years ago. The music press could make or break bands, and it was seen as a gatekeeper to all of these things. And I also question, you know, whether we've lost something culturally now that we don't have those gatekeepers, or the gatekeepers have changed. And there used to be a very kind of sort of scathing kind of like war between the Melody Maker and the NME. They used to be very sort of almost like this sort of Punch and Judy show sort of thing, you know, where the NME would champion bands and the Melody Maker would slag them off. And it was this, but it was petty and silly, but it kind of created debate. And I think debate about music and debate about art is so important, because it kind of regulates it.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of like, it acts as a filter. And I also talk about sort of vicious reviews as well, how important it is to be slagged off sometimes, you know. And in the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, bands took their life into their hands when they released a record. And if you weren't on your game and you released a bad album, you know, the press would come down on you like a ton of bricks. Even if you released a good album, they would just take sides and be very, very personal about it. And that whole process definitely kind of affected me as a person, and that's partly what the book's about as well. Yeah.
Brutal in the 90s, they were.
Absolutely,
they were brutal.
Yeah.
Dog Shit and Diamond.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the. That's one of the chapters in the book is actually called "Dog Shit and Diamonds." It's about a kind of focus on a tour we did with a band called Kingmaker, and the band Kingmaker were kind of like championed by the enemy, and we were championed by the Melody Maker, and it became this sort of like this horrific, vicious catfight between these two sort of like, you know, poles of the media. And we were kind of like seized upon and used in this sort of like kind of chess game, you know.
Mm. Lem, do you remember what you were reading, like who you were reading when you were younger and growing up, and who sort of helped shape you and made you want to become a writer yourself?
So books that were important to me in my teenage years was Catch a Fire by Timothy White, which is the autobiography of Bob Marley. But early days, it was your Enid Blytons and your Famous Fives and Secret Sevens and the Reader's Digest and the
Lion,
the
Witch
and the Broad Road. Yeah, absolutely. All the Christian lot,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They were Baptist, my foster parents, so they would only allow, books were very filtered.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, they were my gentle walk into the imagination, really. Mm. A safe walk into the imagination.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? With the Enid Blyton books and the... And fairy tales and Brothers Grimm, all of the particularly books that led towards Christianity. I didn't realise that at the time.
Mm, yeah.
Later on, I look back and it's obvious that that's the case.
Yeah.
So the Bible played quite a bit, you know. There's a lot of reading of lots of stories and in the Bible where it was John Burnside said, metaphor is as close as a person can get to their environment. Really interesting. Mm. The Bible was all about symbolism and metaphor. Yeah. Mountains, seas split open, burning bushes, etc., etc. Actually, that could have been actually real, but, well, all of them are real, but as metaphor, they speak about the inner world of the writer. This all sounds quite, you know, highfalutin. It's not, metaphor is not highfalutin. And also, Henry Normal said, metaphor, that's a load of crap, that is. Love it. Hey, if you don't get that, listener, it'll be a little while. You'll be in Sainsbury's and the penny will drop.
It will drop, exactly, yeah.
The penny will drop. There you go. We live with metaphor. Thank you. We live with metaphor all of the time. So to be introduced to that so early had, I think, an effect on me, possibly.
Yeah. It's interesting that something like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is a metaphor in itself, isn't it, for the Bible, which is a metaphor for other things. It's a this kind of...
so true.
We live in this kind of like wilderness of mirrors, don't we?
It's so true. And that then, yeah, we live in a wilderness of mirrors, and that's...
all reflecting on each other.
Yeah. Brett, I wanted to ask you a question. Can I ask Brett a question?
Of course you can.
And it's, do you feel like you've arrived at who you are in this, in being a writer?
Now?
Do you feel that this form is a form that you were meant to get to through your creative journey?
I think I sort of know myself better than I ever have through writing, actually. I think that's the most useful thing personally that I've found about writing, is that I've kind of used it as almost as a, I suppose, like people use therapy, where you're kind of, the therapist would sit there and just sort of make you answer your own questions about yourself in the same way the page does that. You know, you're kind of writing things, you know, and I'd be sitting there writing that, oh my God, I'd never realised that about myself before, sort of thing. And you're just on these things that are buried in the subconscious that you find you can uncover through writing. And I'm sure you found that as well.
Well, I always say to people, no, therapy is therapy, and a book can't be therapy, and writing can't be, but creativity can't be, because it relates to a therapeutic process, but the actual process of therapy is so particular to a therapist. However, that is the best explanation of writing as a kind of therapy that I've ever heard. Right. So I'm going to be listening back to this podcast so I can quote you in future when I come to this this idea of writing as therapy. And I will say, well, and that was just the perfect explanation. I can't remember it word for word, but it's on the podcast.
It's on, it's on record now.
We can rewind that little bit.
The world we live in, eh?
So I've always had a relationship with, because I like therapy. I have a therapist. In fact, I'm going to see my therapist straight after this. You couldn't write a book like this without, you couldn't have this childhood that I've had without a little bit of help.
Was it a painful experience writing your memoir?
No. I had 3 years beforehand with all of my files, in which I had to read them intensely for the court case, and after the court case, I then began the book. So I was kind of ready. I did a gig at the Royal Court Theatre in London, where a lot of my psychologist report, which was used for the court case, was read to me for the first time in front of an audience.
The psychologist report on you?
Oh, that was written on me for my court case.
Oh, that's weird.
I heard that a lot of people committed suicide when they take the government to the court and they have a psychologist report written about them for their court case, but then it hurts them so much.
I'm sure. Because it must be so brutal.
So I love the stage.
Yeah.
And I can say things about myself on stage more than I can in person.
Yeah.
And I feel safe there. It's my safe place. It's my safe. So Julie Hesman-Dolsch played the psychologist. We put tickets up. They went in 2 days. And then I heard my report the same time the audience heard it.
Wow.
So I'm saying this to you because when we share deeply personal and painful information, I think it's important for the artist or the writer, the creative person, to be ready to a degree, And my dialogue isn't... I wouldn't throw this on an audience if I was messed up about it.
No. Mm.
Living it is the hard thing.
Sure, yeah.
Living with it is not easy for any of us, any of our stories, but I'll talk about me. Living with it can occasionally be difficult. But that's not a journey to spew over people.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You want to be as kind to other people as you can be to yourself, which is to share openly, to share your best self, even if it is your most vulnerable self.
I think it's worth, if you're what I found with my book, when it came to kind of like unpicking parts of the story that were quite uncomfortable, kind of friction between people.
Mm.
What I really didn't want to do was blame people.
Yes.
I didn't want to kind of set up this thing where I was kind of saying, you're to blame for this or that's to blame for this. It was more of a kind of like, well, I could have dealt with it better, or, and I think if you're blaming people, you're not moving on. You're not kind of getting over these things, are you? And it's important to sort of just grow beyond that, isn't it?
That a book is not a score settling thing, because that's very one note as well.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't want to do that, this sort of like, bitchy kind of like, expose of other people and finger pointing kind of thing. That's the last sort of book I wanted to write, I think it's, as a sort of memoirist, you sort of need to, there needs to be a sort of like a generosity, I think, a generosity of spirit. I think it's important.
I agree. Mm. I agree wholeheartedly. And the reader, I think, wants to feel... Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
I think you both achieve it as well in both of these books. And they're just... They're so rich. And I actually would say that on most memoirs, I wouldn't reread them, because once you know the stories, you've got it. But with both of these, and it's not just because you're sat here, I would happily go back and read again, because I think there's more layers. I think there's more to learn from both of these books. And we could sit here and talk about them for a lot longer.
But we're not going to.
Well, we're not going to, because people listening are going to go out and buy these books and find out more for themselves. We're going to talk about other writers that perhaps you love and that have inspired you. In the book off, which is what I said earlier, each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book you absolutely love and you think that the listeners would like to read or should read if they have.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
So, Lem, before we get into it, what book would you like to put up for the book off?
I'm going to put up Binti for the book off,
right?
Which is written by Nnedi Okorafor.
Okay. And Brett, what are you going for?
I'm not going to go for one of my... I have a sort of series of books that I always go back to, that things like The Collector and Atonement and stuff like that, Birdsong, stuff like that. Something that I've read recently that I really enjoy is a book called How to Stop Time by Matt Haig.
Got this book.
Yeah.
Not read it yet.
Okay.
Great.
I'll tell you why you should.
So we need to decide who's going to go first or second. Len, would you like to be first or second?
Well,
go for it.
Can I go first,
yes,
Brett?
Please.
Shall I?
Yes.
And, okay, all right.
And Brett, would you like to be honked out on your 3 minutes or given the royal bell?
God, they both sound so brutal.
Yes, they are quite.
I think the bell's nicer.
The bell's nicer. Kind
of,
all right.
There's a sort of zen-like quality to the bell, whereas the car horn just reminds me of traffic jams. So.
And yeah, it might incite rage. And so Lem, you're going to be. You've got 3 minutes on the clock.
Okay.
And when it's up, I'm going to honk you out. You don't have to use all three. But it's over to you to.
Is this like going to be like this game where you can't repeat yourself?
No, there's no. There's no.
Can't use the word, same word twice.
Repetition, deviation, hesitation. None of that.
We're going to have trouble there. And I've just got to say, I wasn't prepared for this at all.
No.
So we've
laid the foundation for both of us delivering the most inept.
Yeah.
I don't believe it for a second.
Presentation of these.
I don't believe it for a second.
Don't put pressure on us. Come on, let's say it's going to be inept. It only weighs
keep
up
the bar
from there.
Low. Okay, keep it low.
Keep the bar low.
Well, the bar is very low for you then, Lem. To tell us about Binti. 3 minutes on the clock if you wish to use them. Over to you.
So, first, Binti, welcome to a brand new genre, which I think is called Afro science fiction, something like that. It's one of the very hot things in publishing at the moment, led particularly by a writer called Nnedi, I'm going to get this right, I'm sorry, Nnedi, Nnedi Okorafor, who is a West African, American in particular, writer. Anyway, Binti is about is part of a trilogy, and it is about a student on a planet who runs away to university on another planet. Her parents don't want her to go. They wanted to stay at home. She's from a rural family. And she gets onto a spaceship, which is going to that other planet. And some aliens come onto the spaceship and kill everybody except for her. And she locks herself into a room, into her room. It's... Honestly, I have never read anything like this book, okay? It's very difficult to explain. Try to explain, Lem. Okay, Binti has this thing from home, this mud, which is called, I don't know what it's called, but it's very healthy for her. She's from the Himba ethnic group in this place. It's difficult to explain, except for to say this. You only realise that all of the science fiction you've been reading is by people from the West when you read science fiction by people from other parts of the world. So basically, you get to enjoy science fiction all over again from a totally different perspective. So it refreshes what you already know and it gives you more. It gives you more. That's quite a not specific, but it's worth it, because this woman who's gone on to write films with Viola Davis, she's working with the Oscar winner Viola Davis at the moment on a new film. She's hot, and this is hot of the moment. I know Brett's writer is also hot, you know, so this is a really good book off.
And time is up.
I rang that, didn't I?
Yeah, but that's all right. You had 25 seconds left, but you didn't need them, did you?
I could have said something about the fact that it is a trilogy and the fact it's a novella, so it's very short. And yeah, you get through it in an afternoon.
Wow. I haven't read this book, but I think science fiction at the moment is becoming such a sort of important genre. And yes. I never really read much science fiction when I was younger. But, you know, now we're living in such a... We're living on the cusp of something technologically, that science fiction is the only way that you can really understand things sometimes. I can't read a dry scientific journal and not really understand what's likely to happen in the next 10 years technologically. But I can watch Black Mirror or something like that, and that delves into... So having not... I will give that a spin. Yeah.
Science fiction always told us about who we are. The first interracial kiss was on Star Trek.
It was, wasn't it?
Do you know what I mean?
Uhuru and Kirk, wasn't it? Yeah.
So science fiction has always... Doctor Who has always had kind of forward-thinking subjects just ahead of us. We are living with science fiction right now, right? With the internet.
And, absolutely, we really are. We're in it.
Yeah.
And we've seen, you know, contemporary writers like Ian McEwan or Jeanette Winston incorporating that in their writing as well.
I thought the new Ian McEwan book was really interesting, actually. It's my favourite book that he's written for a while, actually. I'm a huge fan of his, you know, peak period, but I haven't really liked that much that he's written until the latest one. It's called Machines Like Us.
That's right,
It's a really interesting sort of investigation into the sort of like moral dilemmas that are going to face us as a society when kind of AI becomes more sophisticated.
Yeah. And it had something about it, that book, that you couldn't really like anyone in it or anything about it. So you were left feeling quite sort of... Well, I was anyway, a bit empty after it.
I tapered off. I didn't finish it.
Didn't you?
No, I just tapered off. But it's just
I
love him.
He's incredible. Yeah, yeah. He's a great writer.
Yeah.
But it's not Ian McEwan that we're talking about in the book of Brett.
It's not Ian McEwan.
It's Matt Haig. So 3 minutes back on the clock for you to tell us about How to Stop Time.
Okay. I found it a very moving book. I found it so moving and so powerful that I had to go back and reread it as soon as I'd finished it. And there's very few books that I have to do that with. It's a book about love. It's a book about history. The kind of basic synopsis is that it's a story about a sort of 400-year-old man. And he was born in Stuart times or Tudor times or something like that. He was born sort of 400 years ago. And he's got this condition, which means that he ages very, very slowly. And so he falls in love sort of hundreds of years ago, and the woman he falls in love with inevitably didn't have the same condition as him, and she dies. And so it's him mourning her for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's just it's a beautiful, beautiful book. And he kind of like, he's living in contemporary London as a teacher of history, but he's also reflecting back on his past life. And he talks about his mother who was tried as a witch and all of these things. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful book. One of the things that I really liked about it was the way he talks about contemporary London, but he also projects this sort of historical London onto it. So he'll be walking about. I think, in fact, he's living in Hackney, I think. And he's sort of remembering how Hackney used to be hundreds of years ago and saying, well, this road didn't used to exist and stuff like that. And I personally find myself doing that sometimes, walking down. London is so sort of like bubbling with history all the time. I'm always sort of imagining what it was like hundreds of years ago. So for some reason, it just really resonated with me about what I, the kind of things that I think about anyway. And I found it a very moving book, a very beautiful book, a very powerful book. And that's all I have to say about it.
Excellent. Wow.
He's such a good human being, Matt Haig.
Matt Haig is a wonderful man.
It's the only book I've read by him, actually. Are there others that I should
read? Yes, there are, they're all melting from my head.
Well, there's a book about his struggle with depression, isn't there?
Yes. There's two.
I haven't read yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which just recently was made into a play, I think.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's absolutely right.
Listening to Saturday Review.
In Sheffield, I think it was. Yeah, or Leeds. Sheffield or Leeds. Yeah,
because he's written fiction for children, The Humans being one of his first ones, which is a great, great book, and How to Stop Time he's written for adults as well. And then he wrote two non-fiction books.
Notes
on a Nervous Planet was the latest one. And yeah, and he's just a brilliant advocate for
well-being
and he's a really great writer as well.
Do you follow him on Twitter?
I don't really tweet.
Okay, no problem. But his Twitter.
I lurk occasionally. Maybe I should lurk
just
a bit more.
He's just an inspirer, you know. Okay. He's just a good human being. You see it in his Twitter feed. Yeah. He helps
people.
He's a kind.
He's a good egg.
He's a good egg.
And that's a great book, and I really enjoyed your pitch, Brett. In fact, both of them. I don't know Binti, and I don't know Neddy either, the author. So this, listening to you talk about it, it just intrigued me completely.
Wonderful.
To want to know what this new genre, Afro science fiction, you realise by reading her that you haven't read science fiction like this ever before. What a realisation.
And you realise that what the science fiction, you realise that a lot of the references in our science fiction are to do with us and to do with Western society, which is fine because that's where it's written from. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you see science fiction in another, from another culture, it reflects on your own, really. Yeah. You know, which is great.
And with Matt's book, which I have read, you know, you're so right in that it manages to do the. It's about someone who's lived for 400 years, and in some incredibly clever way, he writes the history and the contemporary and the future in it within that. So beautifully, as you say, he sort of weaves that in. Around just a great love story.
But it's like all kind of books. It sounds slightly fantastical, but I think like any great novel, it's just about the simple things in life. It's about sadness, it's about love,
loss.
It's about loss, all of these things that all great sort of writing is about. I think all great writing is about a core of human emotions, and you just clothe it in different clothes, you know.
Well, I love the both pictures, and I love the sound of both of them. I'm gonna say we're gonna take home Eddie Okorafor, I think, of this new genre, this writer.
Yeah, you can't beat a pitch that starts with "Welcome to a new genre." Really,
that's pretty strong, wasn't it, Brett? You know, it was pretty strong. But also, I feel like you're right about science fiction, Brett. It is sort of so relevant at the moment, and it's becoming a genre that is more widely read. Mm-hmm. I remember people talking about science fiction with a small s and a small f, and now I think we're starting to talk about science fiction like it's meant to have been read, you know? But thank you both for both of those pitches, for those recommendations, for your brilliant memoirs, which I can highly recommend to everyone. Afternoons with the Blinds Drawn is by Brett Anderson. It's published by Little Brown. It's available now. And My Name is Why by Lem Sisse, published by Canongate and also out now. Gents, I could sit here all afternoon. We could get more coffee in, but I think it's probably time to leave it there for now anyway. Brett, Lem, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.